Well, good evening and welcome to the second presentation and this our 12th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague Peggy Wright and with help from our webmaster here taking pictures, Hai Wong Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell and Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pollack. Our speakers tonight grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and Adrian, Michigan, and met as freshmen at the College of Worcester in northeastern Ohio. In March of 1961, their senior year, inspired by John F. Kennedy's "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," and wanting to see the world, they stapled together their application to the brand new Peace Corps that Kennedy had just established. They were to be married in August and wanted to serve as Peace Corps volunteers together. In June of 1962, they joined 90 other volunteers in the first group to serve in Liberia, teaching history and English at the Swain Industrial Academy. It was a life-changing experience for them, as it would be for many other Kentucky volunteers. Returning home to complete master's degrees at Michigan State University, Jack in communications, and Ann Jean in history and African studies, they went back overseas where Jack was associate Peace Corps director in Sierra Leone and then director in Fiji. Stateside, Jack worked for the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency and for 13 years was director of the Division of Water in Kentucky. Ann Jean earned a PhD at Ohio State University and joined the faculty of the College of Education at the University of Kentucky in 1975, where she headed the Secondary Social Studies program until her retirement in 2004. While a Fulbright scholar in Ghana, Ann Jean brought back the following Akan proverb: "It is the human being that counts. I call gold, it does not answer. I call cloth, it does not answer. It is the human being that counts." With the 50-year anniversary of the founding of the Peace Corps imminent in 2004, the Wilsons began interviewing returned Peace Corps volunteers with Kentucky connections, and the result is their Voices from the Peace Corps, 50 years of Kentucky volunteers, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2011. And here to share their stories are Jack and Ann Jean Wilson. Welcome.
Thank you, Brian, for inviting us tonight to talk about our book, Voices from the Peace Corps, 50 years of Kentucky volunteers, and thank you to Barnes & Noble for hosting us here this evening. We were in Bowling Green back in April for your book fest, and we're glad to have an excuse to come back to Bowling Green. It's always enjoyable to meet other returned Peace Corps volunteers, and we're lucky to have dinner this evening with four or five more here in this community. Is there anybody else here tonight has been a Peace Corps volunteer or has a Peace Corps volunteer in their family? Great. Then some of what we have to say will sound familiar to you as well, I'm sure. Let's begin with a bit of history. A year ago tonight, we were in Michigan at a reenactment of a very important event in the 50 years of Peace Corps, because it was at 2 a.m. on October 20th, 1960, that a very tired presidential candidate, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, arrived at the University of Michigan Union, hoping to get a few hours sleep before going back on the campaign trail. He was met there by over 5,000 students who had been standing in a cold, drizzling rain, somewhat like what it was at least in Lexington last night. And he gave what he later referred to as the longest two-minute 2-minute speech in the history of the campaign. And in that speech, he asked the students how many who were preparing to be teachers or engineers or doctors might be willing to serve their country in a less developed country such as Ghana or India. Those students took up the challenge and in a matter of 2 weeks had 1,000 signatures on a scroll that said we would meet that challenge. And they presented it to candidate Kennedy later in Toledo, Ohio. Then, of course, JFK made the concept of forming a Peace Corps a campaign promise. And in his inaugural address, made those famous statements, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Less well known, or at least less frequently quoted, but of equal importance to the concept of the Peace Corps was the following sentence, in which he said, my fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America can do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. And Peace Corps became a working together organization. A week or so after the inauguration, the president called his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, who was then head of the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, and asked him to come to Washington and organize the Peace Corps. The energetic, dynamic, visionary Shriver knew very little about forming federal bureaucratic agencies. But he assembled a group of volunteers, some from government, some from the private sector, to organize the Peace Corps. He visited heads of state across the world in newly independent nations, asking what their skill needs were and soliciting invitations for Peace Corps volunteers. And then on March 1st, 1961, President Kennedy signed an executive order establishing the Peace Corps. By September of 1961, there were over 400 volunteers in the field. Congress had yet to pass authorization for the Peace Corps or provide funding. Shriver had used idealism, enthusiasm, and a little bit of presidential discretionary funds to set up this agency. And that agency, over the next 50 years, would impact the views of America by people in 139 countries, impact American foreign policy, and impact more than 200,000 American citizens' views of the world for the next 50 years. Angie?
As Brian said, we were seniors in college in 1961, and we went to Liberia in 1962. We still have Liberian friends here in Kentucky and in Liberia. In fact, tomorrow we're taking two very dear Liberian friends, one of whom taught with us and one who was our student, to Frankfurt to a citizenship ceremony. They're becoming U.S. citizens. They were in Liberia during the Civil War. And of course, we're very proud to say that the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize several weeks ago were Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's presently running for a re-election as president in Liberia, and Lema Bui, who I just bought her book here, you can find it, who was part of the group of women who forced Taylor and the warlords to stop the war in 2003. As a retirement project, we chose to interview returned Peace Corps volunteers from all decades and all parts of the world because we thought that Peace Corps stories ought to be part of the historical archives. And in fact, you can, and we've got information here if you're interested, you can go into the Louis B. Nunn Oral History Center at UK and you can listen to the interviews. There are almost 100 of them up online where you can listen and read and search them. So we're excited about that. We were very lucky to work with the Oral History Center, and then the person who was the head of the Oral History Center at that point was also a co-editor of the Kentucky Remembered series, which is the oral history series for the University Press, and he suggested we write a book based on the interviews, and we did.
Our interviews spanned the five decades and came from all parts of the state of Kentucky. Although I must confess, we don't have anybody from Bowling Green, and I'm sorry about that. For example, Martin Tracy, a proud descendant of Jane Kenton, sister of Simon Kenton, after whom Kenton County is named, grew up in Murray. He served in the Army after high school and then returned to Murray for college. Martin and his wife Patsy went to Turkey to teach English from 1965 to 1967. Martin served in the International Social Security Administration in Geneva, Switzerland, later taught at Iowa University and Southern Illinois University, and he finished his career as Associate Dean of Social Work at the University of Kentucky before retiring in Murray, where he and his wife are currently active local citizens. Philip Curd grew up in Louisville, served in Guinea between 1964 and 65. He returned to Kentucky to get a medical degree, using what he had learned in Peace Corps about community development. He went to Jackson County and started the White House Clinic after having a community meeting to discover what the health needs and desires were of the local citizens. He received the prestigious Sergeant Shriver Award for Distinguished Humanitarian Service in 1992. He then completed a preventive medicine residency, got a master's in public health, and became an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky Medical School. Rona Roberts grew up in Wayne County on a farm without running water. She did community development work in the Philippines between 1973 and 75 and used what she learned to become an organizer of legal service programs and then to work with citizen action groups such as the Pritchard Committee. She now, with her husband, hosts cornbread suppers every Monday at her home in Lexington, connecting people and doing a kind of stateside community development. Aaron Schreiberg, who taught English in a city in China with many Muslim residents from 2004 to 2006, comes from a Jewish family. On his father's side, his great-grandfather from Lithuania opened a scrap metal company in Somerset. On his mother's side, his family came from England and got a land grant in Rhineyville, Hardin County, after the American Revolution. His great-grandfather, Zachariah Riney, was Abraham Lincoln's teacher. Aaron recently completed a master's in Asian studies at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and has been back to China for two summers. These are only four of the very interesting individuals in our book. About 25% of the people we interviewed applied from Kentucky and returned to Kentucky. The others are transplants like us, and some have moved on to other places. As of February 2011, there were 1,383 Kentuckians who have served over the first 50 years, or at least applied from Kentucky over that time period. And to the best of our knowledge, there are about 72 to 75 people serving today as Peace Corps volunteers overseas. What we'd like to do now is read some excerpts from the interviews that are in the book. We follow the life cycle of volunteers over the 11 chapters, from why we went to citizens of the world the rest of our lives.
So the first chapter is why we went. Lee White's, she was in Bulgaria, 2001, 2003. Rationale for joining was practical and idealistic, and it would resonate with many volunteers from all decades. Lee felt the need to do something more than get a regular job or go to graduate school right after college. I knew several people who graduated from Bellarmine who'd gone into the Peace Corps, and we had one professor of philosophy who was in the Peace Corps, and she talked about it frequently in her classes. So it always sounded interesting to me. Plus, it meant living abroad, traveling, finding a new language, learning a new culture, all those things. And then there was a part of me that wanted to serve my country in some way. I thought I would be a good ambassador of my country, and at the same time, I knew I would be getting a lot out of it. Lee married a Bulgarian while she was in Bulgaria and came back to Louisville. She's now passed her foreign service exam, and they're waiting for an assignment overseas. So maybe she will be an ambassador.
The second chapter is getting in. Maybe some of you know Kay Roberts, who's executive director of the Kentucky-Ecuador Partners Program. Kay was in Ecuador from 1982 to 84. I don't remember too much about it, except that when I got to the medical exam, I did not pass because I didn't have enough iron in my blood. They agreed to let me work on that a little bit, so I went home and spent probably about a month eating red meat and beets and broccoli. Then I went back and had another blood test, and my iron level was just fine, and away I went. She had a phone interview, all the pertinent background checks, and got letters and recommendations. She got her first choice of countries, Ecuador.
And she's still working with Ecuador. That's kind of unusual. The third chapter is training. Training at the beginning was in American universities, but by the late 1960s, it was done in-country. This is a West African volunteer, Deborah Schweitzer, Mali, 1993-96. Remember training as pretty grueling because you're just in a state of culture shock. The official language of Mali is French, so we had French training. Halfway through, we had local language training, for me, Bambara. I was in small business development, so we had training about the economy of Mali, types of businesses and small business projects others had done and what you could hope to do. We also had culture training, learning about the culture of Mali, the people, the history, their beliefs, their way of life. It was morning till evening every day, and even meals were not a break because even eating was different there. Going to the bathroom was different. There was some food I didn't care for, but the food we had in training was quite good. It was mostly rice and chicken and different kinds of meat. But when you eat in Mali, you have a communal bowl and everyone sits around it on stools low to the ground. If there's any meat, it gets placed in the middle of the bowl. You eat with your right hand because your left hand is for the toilet. And you just take the meat portion that's in front of you. It's impolite to reach over other people's hands and take something from their area of the bowl. You wash your hands before you eat by pouring water from a big plastic teapot. We were introduced to the endemic diseases, malaria and guinea worm, and how to treat our water by putting it through a mesh cheesecloth filter and then treating it with either bleach or iodine tablets. You had a little medical kit to take to your site, and you learned how to prick your finger to do a malaria slide. It was scary because coming from America, you're used to having very minor illnesses. You're not used to dealing with snakes and malaria and guinea worm. Malnutrition didn't really affect us, just intestinal parasites and dysentery. After a week, we all got paired up with a family, two to a family. So in the morning, we would get on a bus and go to the training facility, and in the evening, we would go back to the village. You would stay with the family overnight to get more exposure to the culture and how you were going to live when you eventually went to your site. You used a latrine, you had a bucket bath, you had a lantern at night or candles, you had a mosquito net on your cot. A significant thing about the family you stayed with was that they got to give you their your Malian name. They gave you your first name and then you took their last name. Mine was Khadidia Kante. Family names in Mali are handed down and associated with specific professions. So I was from a blacksmith family.
In chapter 4, Living, we describe homes, a typical day, recreation and travel, communication and safety and security. I'll read something from Jim Archambault. Jim, many of you may know more broadly in Kentucky as a photographer, a nature photographer, and a publisher a writer of photographic books on Kentucky. Jim Archambault, Philippines, 1966-1968, first lived with a rather well-off family where he shared a large room beneath the main house with another volunteer and had amenities of electricity and running water. After 4 or 5 months, he moved to a fishing village on the ocean about 3 or 4 miles outside of the provincial capital. He took a bus or a jeepney into town for his work in an office. "I wanted a different experience," he said. His wooden house stood on stilts about 10 feet off the ground and was attached to another house. Essentially, I had a bedroom. Outside was a thatched roof place that had a 50-gallon tin drum, and I would take my baths there. Jim ate mostly fish and rice. The fish was fresh, right out of the ocean. It was fabulous.
The next chapter is the toughest. Maybe some of you remember that there was a commercial, I think in the 80s, for Peace Corps, "The Toughest Job You'll Ever Love." What we found in interviewing people was that the toughest things were male-female relationships, lack of privacy, lack of structure, slower pace, language, loneliness and isolation, food, and health issues. We have some great food stories. Here's one. Growing up in rural Kentucky, Cecil McFarland, Micronesia 1972-74, Philippines 1974-76, had eaten corn, green beans, mashed potatoes, roast beef, and chicken. But he said, "I don't think I'd ever eaten rice in my life except as a dessert pudding. I hadn't eaten any kind of ocean fish." The islanders loved turkey tails shipped in from somewhere. But the most interesting thing we ate there was dog. My wife and I walked over the mountains to another village where they were having a little festival. We each had a banana leaf, and as you walked down the line, you got your yam, fish, and rice out of the baskets. The last basket was all closed up, and when I got to it, they opened it up, and there was this burnt to a crisp dog. Looking back on it, it was a test. It got real quiet, and they handed me a knife. I reached down and whacked off a leg, put it on my banana leaf, and walked off. It didn't taste like chicken. After that, I always said, I never met a dog I didn't like. They're back in Anderson County, and they have at least 2 or 3 dogs.
The sixth chapter's title is the other part of that commercial, "Job You'll Ever Love." And is this comes from Harold Freeman, and who was editor at the Courier Journal when we interviewed him. He was in Ethiopia from 1965 to 67 and declared his Peace Corps job teaching math and science, quote, "was the most interesting assignment I had in my working life." He explained, I was supposed to be an experiment teacher, working with 12 sections of 7th graders. My job was to do things like when we moved on to sound as a topic in science, I would take in rubber bands of various thicknesses and lengths. You hold them between your fingers and pluck them, and you get different pitches. If you pitch them more tightly, the pitch goes up. If you stretch them more tightly, the pitch goes up. They all knew that sound was the vibrations of molecules in the air as transmitted by the eardrum, or some such sentence. So what does vibration mean? Put your hand on your throat as you talk. Or, I've got a lower voice than you, so put your hand on my voice box as I speak and you'll feel a different thing. One day, I finished one of my sessions where instead of standing up and droning on about a camera being a device for making a record, which they had to copy down slowly and laboriously, I had done something that helped them learn, and they'd all gathered around me on the floor. One little boy followed me out to the empty room that served as the teacher's lounge, and he said, "Mr. Freeman, if you have some free time, could we do some more of that?" You know, that's about the highest compliment a teacher can get.
The seventh chapter is telling stories, and Peace Corps volunteers love to tell stories. At one point, because this book manuscript was 100 pages too long, somebody suggested that we cut the chapter on telling stories, and we said, we can't do that. So we cut something from all the chapters. Winnie Yunker was in Ukraine from 2000 to 2002. Her story about getting in is wonderful. It's in the Getting In chapter and is very long because she first applied to the Peace Corps in 1961 when it started, and she didn't have a college degree, so she couldn't go. She went when she retired. Meeting President Clinton was a highlight for Winnie Yunker. She said, "I had to be 65 and go 5 miles away from home, 5,000 miles away from home, to meet a U.S. president. Clinton came there in June after I went there in February, and he gave a speech in a huge square in Kiev. There were just hundreds of thousands of people there. Peace Corps always took care to give us access to things like that, so there were probably about 60 volunteers there. We were all lined up on a fence that was at the perimeter of the open space where he was speaking. Somebody told him that we were there, that there were volunteers on that fence, so he came along the fence shaking hands with each of us. I had in mind to say to him, 'God bless you, Mr. President,' but when he got to me and took my hand, my voice was frozen. I couldn't say anything. I was speechless. So he passed on. But I noticed way down at the end of the volunteers, there was this space with nobody in it. So I snuck around and went down there. So this time, when he came to me, I said, 'God bless you, Mr. President.' Well, Clinton is so smart. He looked at me and took my hand and said, 'Nice to see you again.'"
The eighth chapter is Friends Can Become Family. A highlight of that chapter is Charlene McGrath's story. She served in a very successful vaccination against smallpox project in Afghanistan from 1969 to 1971. In 1970, I met Mohammed Alam Balouche. My fiancé, Mike, was a Peace Corps English teacher stationed in Kang, a small village near the Iranian-Afghan border. There he met Alam, who was several years older and from a prominent family. Mike moved to Kabul in 1970, and Alam, who was attending Kabul University at the time, was a frequent guest at his home. I was there quite often and enjoyed drinking coffee and talking with Alam. In fact, when Mike went home on home leave for a month because he was extending for a year, Alam would come over for a cup of coffee and a visit. He did not want me to be sad because I was alone. When the Russians invaded Afghanistan, he moved his family to Zabul, Iran. And from time to time, he would send us items made by his family and ask us to market them for him. Of course, we kept them and sent Alam money. We lost track of Alam probably in early 1990s. Then in early 2005, I received an email from Alam's nephew, who had worked as a translator for American troops in Afghanistan, asking if I was the Charlene Keeling from North Carolina who had nicknamed her mother Gray Mouse. He told me that Alam was living in Kabul with his family and wondered how Mike and I were doing and if we had children. I emailed back saying that Mike was deceased and that we had two daughters and the elder was getting married soon. In the fall of 2005, after my daughter's wedding in June, I moved to Northern Kentucky. I had sold my home in Jackson and returned to close on the house. I drove on to Hazard to see some friends I had worked with there and was very surprised to see a package waiting for me. I opened the box and immediately burst into tears. Alam had sent from Afghanistan a wedding dress for my daughter, made of white silk covered with gold embroidery. He had sent a two-piece, lovely, dark green silk outfit for my younger daughter, and he sent me just a glorious Mother of the Bride dress made of white and pink silk with lots of gold embroidery. I was overwhelmed. I had not spoken to Alam since I left Afghanistan in 1971, and yet he treated me like a family member. Mike was his brother, his good friend, and Alam wanted to be sure that his friend's wife and children had wedding clothes. I was so touched. The act of generosity just meant so much to me and my family, and it typifies the way Afghans are. They give you everything they have, whether you have a little or a lot. They are so open-hearted and welcoming.
And when we interviewed Charlene, we saw the dresses. The next chapter is coming home, because most of us do come home. When Joshua Mike Nevis, 2004 to 2006, talked about returning from the Caribbean in 2006, he could have been a returned volunteer from any decade. He said, "I came home to a very shocking world of materialism and unnecessary pace. The abundance of stuff in America. Walking into a Walmart or Meijer or Kroger the first time. Relationships seemed artificial and superficial here. People say, 'How was your experience, Josh?' I say, 'It was great. I had an awesome time. Glad to be back.' They say, 'Okay, let's go to Dairy Queen.'"
Chapter 10 is entitled "Making a Difference." Most volunteers are pretty modest about how much difference we made. And, of course, volunteers often can't be sure of what their impact was. Ashley Netherton, Senegal, 2003-2005, said, "I wondered, as I was leaving, if I had any impact, because so many projects fail. And you get excited about doing a project, and then the goats eat all the trees, and all this hard work is down the drain. And being a female is tough because they're not used to listening to a woman tell them to do anything." Then a couple of months after I was home, my brother, that's her Senegalese family brother, called me on the phone in Kentucky. I can't believe he did it, because it must have cost him a fortune, to let me know that they had just planted some more trees in the village. He did it with some guys on his own. And sometimes impact takes a while. older volunteer, Letty Herr, Senegal 2001 to 2003, returns to her Senegalese village for several months each year, and she's built a house there. By 2010, she could report that there were 70 students and four teachers in the village school that she had helped build. For while she was there, she had built two classrooms. Three village students had gone on to secondary school, and one girl and two boys.
Tom Boyd, Columbia, 1964-66, told us, "I'm a citizen of the world, thanks to Peace Corps." Richard Parker, Cote d'Ivoire, 1973-74, Morocco, 1976-78, told us, "My real Peace Corps job was the rest of my life." And so that's where we get the title for our last chapter, Citizens of the World for the Rest of Our Lives. And I'm going to tell a story that Lloyd Jones, Columbia, 1973-75, who's vice president of Fire King Securities in Louisville, told about explaining how the Peace Corps affected him as a businessman. "We had a deal in Nicaragua when Somoza was still in power and the Sandinistas were fighting. We sent a bunch of containers of goods and I went into Managua, which was basically a war zone. People looked at me and said, 'What in the world are you doing here? We're in the middle of a civil war.' And I said, 'Well, you know, you need to buy security products.' I came back after that visit. Somoza was kicked out and the Sandinistas took over. Everybody up here is going crazy because we just sent these containers. How are we going to get paid?" And I said, "Well, you're only as good as your distributor." So I picked up the phone to call the guy, and he said, "Yeah, it's kind of business as usual despite all the problems, but we couldn't get the money out because the Sandinistas came in and froze all the assets in the bank. They were trying to get Somoza's money, which he'd taken with him, because he's out in a boat in the Caribbean and they're trying to chase him down and kill him. Well, I told everybody, 'Don't worry, we'll get our money back.' They weren't granting any visas, so I went to Panama and was there with my distributor, who was a former East German living there with his own business. Great guy. We talked about it. And he said, 'Well, you know, they ransacked the Nicaragua embassy. Everything's gone. The Sandinistas are over there running around with those little bandanas of theirs. Let's go over and talk to them.' So we go over there. There basically was a chair and a desk. Everything else is gone. Bullet holes. They'd shot this place up even in Panama. Anyway, I go in there and I start talking to this guy, and he's a campesino from the countryside. I can tell by his accent in Spanish. So I start talking to him the way I learned Spanish in Colombia, and we just clicked. Here I was in my expensive suit and tie talking to this guy, and after telling him about these security products and so on, and saying we've got a lot of money and I can't get it out, he gave me a visa. I'm convinced to this day the only reason he gave me a visa was because I was able to talk with him just a little bit of a country accent like a campesino. It was connecting to people. That was the biggest, most important thing of the culture in Latin America that you learned. You didn't go in there and just start talking about business. You had to go in and get this personal relationship built up with these guys. Forget this being on time, the sense of urgency. It's not going to work. So I got to Nicaragua and my distributor says, 'I can't believe you got a visa, but we go over to the Banco Nacional. The place is pretty well ransacked,' and I go in and talk with this guy in his little red bandana. He's the Sandinista in charge of releasing any funds out of the country. I had to say I'd like to get paid, but I didn't say it that way. I went in there with my distributor and we talked with this guy for 2 hours and we had coffee and we drank and we talked. And when I went in his office, right behind him was one of our Fire King fireproof filing cabinets. He said, 'We're not going to release the money and approve expenditures for imports on anything but essential products for food, shelter, and clothing.' I sat there and convinced him that the product right behind him was an essential product. He had to have it to store his important documents. He understood. He got it. He said, 'Okay.' And not only did we get the money out, but we sold him a bunch more products. Anyway, the Peace Corps experience helped me a lot in being able to deal with situations. Peace Corps did a great job of saying, and I'll never forget this, it takes just as long to learn the wrong way as it does the right way. When you're dealing with these people, you have to realize there's not one right way all the time. There's no right way to do it except for coming up to the end of a mutually beneficial deal."
recently returned and current volunteers continue to serve effectively, creatively overseas and back here in Kentucky. We conclude by reading part of an email from volunteer Deborah Payne, sent when she was in the second year as a public health worker in Uganda from 2007 to 2009. She lived and worked with the Kotosi Women Development Trust in a fishing village on the northern shore of Lake Victoria. In her job, she developed programming around water and sanitation, built biosand filters with her co-workers, made soap as an income-generating activity, promoted hand-washing and health clubs. She now works for a local environmental organization in Berea, and last May took Berea students for a month-long experience in the place where she had worked in Uganda. In the November 2008 email, Deborah was clear about what a Peace Corps volunteer might be able to do. The gift that Peace Corps offers is time and experience, not money. Within the 2 years of our service, we have time to offer skills, education, and knowledge. Though we might offer some money, that money is directed at a project that is homegrown. We are here to stimulate projects from the ground up. Deborah also described her counterparts who became her friends. My experience as a Peace Corps volunteer has been successful in large part because I work with a collective of tremendously motivated, engaging women. My relationships with the women have deepened into those of aunties, sisters, and closest friends. The obligatory greetings we exchange when we gather have become full of love, laughter, and sincerity. And she was clear about what she had learned. For me, Deborah concluded, Peace Corps has opened a door to the rest of the world. While I have always appreciated other cultures as a member of a well-traveled family, never before have I had the opportunity to immerse myself in an experience that has given me time to understand our positions as Americans, our tremendous opportunities, and the responsibilities we, in turn, must address. I'm sure that my experience in Uganda will shape not only my next career steps, but my path in life. To live modestly, to be aware of my role as an American, and to value relationships and a development approach that comes from the bottom up.
Of course, there are many facts about the Peace Corps and stories about the Peace Corps that we haven't told you, and the people here would have stories as well. But we invite you now to ask some questions if there's a little bit of time, and to consider buying and reading the book. Any proceeds from this book will go to projects in Peace Corps countries. Thank you.
Question right back here.
How are Peace Corps people paid?
How are they paid? Most volunteers receive a monthly living allowance based roughly on the local economy and what their counterparts might earn. Then they receive at the end of their service for each month they serve a small stipend. When we were volunteers, that stipend was the monthly amount was $75 a month. So we got roughly $1,500 each when our time was up. I think it's closer to $6,000 or $7,000 total for the 27 months. Now, in our day, that was equivalent to buying a new Volkswagen so we could travel around Europe on our way home, and maybe pay rent and the first semester of tuition for graduate studies.
They just got a raise. It's up to about $7,400 now.
What, a year?
For the 27 months.
You don't get it until you get back.
Yeah, you don't get that money until you return.
You pay only if you survive.
Yes, that's right.
over here?
Yeah.
And that can be applied to student loans also?
It can. Well, and the other issue on student loans, student loans can be deferred during your Peace Corps service, so you don't have to make payments during that time period. Yes, when you get back, you can apply it wherever you wish.
And there are programs at various institutions, including Western Kentucky, where you can get fellowships as Return Peace Corps volunteers for graduate school. So that's another possibility when you get back.
You're also eligible for some scholarships that you might not have been eligible for. It makes you more attractive.
Yes,
for some scholarships.
Exactly.
I understand there are three goals for Peace Corps. If there are, what goal was most important to these returned Peace Corps volunteers and their interns?
Be sure we tell people what the three goals are. The first goal is to offer technical assistance to people in other countries, what they need. The second goal is for them to learn something about Americans, and the third goal is what we call bringing the world back home, is to bring that what we've learned back to the United States. And the third goal typically has not had as much emphasis. It's been up to us to share that, really. I think that our chapter, the last chapter that talks about the impact on us, is much longer than the chapter on making a difference. Although we did make a difference, sometimes that's, as we said, hard to calculate.
Yeah, I think most return volunteers are pretty modest about what they think they may have contributed. But you get surprised sometimes. And I would use just one example. 30-some years after our service in Liberia, a woman who had been a student of ours appeared in Lexington for the graduation of a nephew from the University of Kentucky. She got in touch, she came out to our house, and in the course of conversation went to our books case in the basement following a conversation and pulled from the rack the book that I had used to teach African literature to her, and she had named the story that was her favorite before she went to find the book. You never know what your impact is going to be.
Are you required to make periodic reports monthly or while you're there?
Some of them were recently returned volunteers, and you all have been there more recently, could say something about that. We were not when we were volunteers, but that was at the very beginning.
Yeah, you are required to make reports about not only your primary site, but also your secondary project, and I think it was every 6 months, and more extensive at 1 year.
Right. Yes, everybody has a secondary project, and we talk about those in the book. And we had those when we were there, too. They weren't called that, but that's something that developed. Yeah.
One of the great stories Jack tells in the book about is his experience about introducing that great Kentucky game of basketball in Liberia. Tell us about it, Jack.
Well, you know, American, particularly American men, not that women didn't too, but like to play basketball. I wasn't from Kentucky at that time, but the first group of volunteers that went into Liberia introduced into the high schools a basketball league. Most of the schools were in the capital of Monrovia, I happen to be at this upcountry bush school. But we learned to play basketball. I had one kid who had played at the YMCA in Monrovia. We leveled off a dirt court, went to the bush, cut down some trees, got a local blacksmith to fabricate some rims, and won the first national high school basketball championship. Yes?
I will be graduating from West End today, and I'm going to start the application process for this one.
Good.
October 1st deadline for the fall. I just wondered what kind of advice you guys would have as far as starting the really extensive application process and the things that I could get involved with as far as my volunteer work within the community that would kind of bring me out a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a good question. Good that you're starting now. They're trying to be better about that, faster about making decisions, but that doesn't always happen. It's always good not to be too particular about where you want to go. You can refuse at least once if you don't want to go someplace, but it depends on what the needs are in places. It is important to have volunteer work. I mean, we've known people who've taught English as a second language. I don't know what your interest is. There's still a lot of teaching English. That's about 35% of the volunteers. Our teachers also math and science. I was very lucky after the first couple years of Peace Corps, no social studies people got to teach. For understandable reasons, you don't teach history of another country, but I was lucky because I got to learn African history and my students did too. And they had never had that opportunity before. What else would you say?
Volunteer work with children.
Children, right.
Youth development. Maybe an after-school program is a really good experience to work with. An after-school program, because that really shows that youth development.
Yes, and that's another possibility.
How competitive is it for everyone who applies? Are people routinely turned down, or is there a long
We don't have the current numbers. There are a lot more people applying now. Now, there was a while when, I don't know about the rest of you who are returned volunteers, but somebody would say, there's still a Peace Corps, you know, because there just wasn't any publicity about it. I think that's changed to some extent. But I don't know what the current figures are.
They would say about 30% of people that begin the application become volunteers, but they would also say that many of those individuals self-select out of the process by accepting jobs, do not complete the medical phase, which can be rather rigorous.
Yeah.
And so most people who do pursue it and are determined about it, usually with the basic, you know, with the qualifications, you can go. So it's very difficult, but even Peace Corps Chicago or Washington really doesn't have those numbers.
Just making it through the application.
Yeah, well, and the application is all online now, and you only have to have three recommendations. References. When we went, you had to have 12. Can you believe that? And it was all, you know, this long application. So in some ways, it's not as bad. And of course, you can start it and then stop it and go back. And there's some stories in here about folks doing that. I mean, Aaron, who went to China, describes how he'd go into the library and he'd do, you know, the first page or whatever it was, and they'd stop and then he'd go back and keep adding to it.
There were, in 2010, there were about 13,000, between 13,000 and 14,000 applications, and there were roughly 4,000 volunteers.
If you look on the Peace Corps website, it says security is the first thing that Peace Corps is concerned about. There's a separate security officer in every program now. Again, some of these folks who've just come back can talk about that, but we talk about that. We have lots of examples of that from in the book. And now people have to let somebody know in the Peace Corps, of the Peace Corps administration, where they're going if you're leaving your site. So there's a lot of concern about security, and some folks say that that's one reason why they chose the Peace Corps, because it was their parents would feel more at ease about them being taken care of by the Peace Corps, and some other programs that you go on, there isn't the same concern. Those of you who've been...
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
Security was a major concern here in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Every time we left our site, we had to call the security officer and let him know.
Yeah, it's very different from what it was years ago.
And I think the Peace Corps is the way to go overseas because of the security concerns and also the health.
Yes.
Yes,
we never had such good health care as we had for the 6 years that we were in Peace Corps, and that's one reason why we believe in universal health care.
Over here.
I graduated in May also with a master's in English. I've taught English.
Right.
I was thinking of doing 2 years of AmeriCorps, and then after those 2 years doing Peace Corps. Does that make sense?
Sure, and there are people in that we interviewed who did that. There's a gal who went to Gabon, who did AmeriCorps both in Eastern Kentucky and someplace out west for 2 years, and then went into Peace Corps. And there was another older volunteer, I think, who did AmeriCorps before she went into Peace Corps. So yes, that's a fine thing to do.
And let us comment on that. You don't have to be 22 or 26 to join the Peace Corps. The current oldest volunteer, I believe, is 86. And last month we were in Louisville, and there was a couple in their late 50s who had just sold their house and had been accepted for a program in Thailand?
I think so.
In Thailand, I believe. So you can go at any age. Peace Corps has always been a little picky about health issues, and some of us who are beyond that 50 age note that sometimes that means they get a little more picky about some of those things. But even those can be overcome with some persistence. We've known a number of people who, when Peace Corps first said, "Nah, we don't think so because of X or Y," who persisted and found a way to go beyond that and ended up as successful volunteers.
It usually happens when you're older volunteer that you're placed in urban centers, and so there's a lot more support for you as a volunteer 62. And we went in, and that means old volunteers. I was like,
7% are over 50, and the average age is 28.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, time for one more question. Back here.
Yeah. Is the program read any budget cuts?
Yes.
We
everything in the federal government is under budget cut threat.
We advocate. We lobby every March because we're on the National Peace Corps Association Director's Circle, and it's always interesting to do. I mean, we did all the folks in Kentucky last March, and generally speaking, Peace Corps has bipartisan support, and the budget that Obama asked for this year was $440 million. Can we get this right? The Peace Corps budget is...
roughly, a couple of years ago was roughly equivalent to the budget for all of the military bands.
I think last year it was $400 million requested and approved.
It was $440 and it's been cut to
$400. Yeah, I know they cut $26 million in some adjustments, but that's the highest budget that they've ever had in history.
That they've had. Peace Corps' budget for 50 years of $7.8 billion will be spent in this year's defense budget in 5 days. We spent more in the first 9 days enforcing the no-fly zone in Libya than this year's budget. So, you know, if you want some comparisons, those are comparisons.
It's been our pleasure to have you here this evening. We hope you'll join us next month when David Keeling will be here to talk about Gabon and our faraway places here. And we'll be happy to sign some books up here, won't we?
Sure.
So thank you and good evening.